Yeah, thank you first of all for having the possibility to be here, Doug, and Norman? And it's very good to be back in Santa Barbara again after quite some time. In this talk, I would like to speak about some work I have been starting with Richard Nelson relatively recently. It's still a work in progress, so don't expect any full-fledged results, and we are working on planets and binaries, and did, I would just call it, some numerical experiments. That's Richard Nelson from QMUL from London. Just very brief statistics. You know all this. We have about, in total, 120 exosolar planets as of today. There are several systems with two or more planets, 12 systems so far, and one confirmed transiting planet, several Oakley candidates. We heard Matt talking a couple of days ago about TR10. My favorite is, of course, TR3, since I was part of the collaboration there. We did some follow-up observations on this, and from my point of view, it's not quite ruled out yet, even though some other people may say it is. But as long as there are no, I think, really confirmed radial velocity curves on all of these, I think it's very hard to say whether it is really a planet or not. Okay, and then in red today, there are also several planets in binary stellar systems, and those are the objects I would like to talk about. So here's the list, which I have retrieved from a very recent paper on the internet, in fact, just a couple of days ago, by Eggenberger, Udry, and Mayor. That's their complete list of 15 objects here. And you can see the distance of the two stars, which is given here in the first column, second column, ranges from several thousand astronomical units to only 20 in the range of our own solar system. The semi-major axis of the planet is given here. And you can see that some planets are very close, only a fraction of an AU, while others are several AU away from the star here. And the masses of the planets vary also quite considerably. There are two planetary systems here on this, Upsilon Andromeda and 55 Cancri, where I've just given ranges here. So these are the ranges of the three planets in both cases here. And in general, as will come out later, the planets seem to be partly quite massive. And these are the eccentricities of the planetary system. And I pointed out in red the system which was called was considered recently by Yang King and Norman Murray, and about the high eccentricity here, how to generate this system with this very high eccentricities and relatively low distance from the star. So this is just a little overview, and I just would like to point out how strange these systems sometimes can be. I retrieved it from the internet, the Gamma Cepheus system here, where you have two stars with 1.6 and 0.4 solar masses orbiting each other, and the distance of those two stars, the semi-major axis, that is only 22 astronomical units with an eccentricity of 0.44. And here are the orbits drawn. This is the center of mass, first star in red here, secondary star in lower red, and then the blue circle, or blue line rather, is the planet orbiting the more massive star here. At a distance of 2 AU and eccentricity of 0.2. And in comparison, you just have drawn to scale here the solar system. So, and of course, we will not consider this system presently, but it just gives an indication what systems you can find. Here is a graph from the very recent paper by Eggenberger et al., where we have plotted the mass, m sine I, of the planet versus the period of the planet. And in red, the planets found in binary stars, and the open circles are the planets around single stars. So what can be seen here? One thing first here is a very empty region here. So you tend to have, which is the general trend, if you look for planets around single stars, the open circles, that you have lower mass planets when you approach the star, yes, and more higher mass planets at distances which go, or periods which go beyond around 100 days here. And one striking feature, pointed out already by others, CMAC in particular, and that you have some planets here in which are in binaries, which are relatively close to the star and are considerably more massive than the typical planet you find in this region. Yeah, so that if you find massive planets, let's say closer to the star, then they are more likely, or some people say even if you're below a certain threshold here, they are only planets in binaries, which is quite striking, in fact.
Really, if I were to remove all the open circles,
yes,
I see an even distribution of
That's correct.
The absence, I mean, this strangeness of this mm-hmm. diagram is not the presence of the red in that region, but it's the absence of the open circle. Is it not true?
Possibly. Yes, possibly. I mean, I just claim now what the observers say, but you're right. If you look just only at the red ones, you could say this is an even distribution. Yes, but nevertheless,
open circle. That's
but nevertheless, even if your argument is correct, there is a difference between planets around single stars and planets around binaries. No matter how you look at it, yeah, there's some difference.
But it's on the low mass.
It's single stars are odd.
Yes, I mean. But I agree. I mean, you could say that the...
It's very important to your conclusion, right, in the end.
Do I have any conclusions? I don't know. Okay, I will just let you know. I will modify it accordingly.
Not anymore.
Yes.
So the two questions, actually. One obvious one is, has anybody looked at this seriously? If this is
They claim it is. They claim it is, yes.
I think if you ask Andrew... Comments, he would not say it's statistically significant.
I think the problem in terms of statistical significance is you can put out criteria and get very low false alarm probabilities. The question is, when you look at these data, your eyes process and your mind processes some very hard to define number of possible patterns. And if you're processing 1,000 patterns in your mind, and you find one with a false alarm probability of 1 in 1,000, does that mean anything?
It means your mind is nuts.
Well, anyhow, okay.
It has to do with the definition of a binary system here. My understanding from talking to the observers is that these stars have been searched very unevenly.
Right.
So
yes. I can only say these are the most recent results that the observers give us, and they say themselves that even if you look at these binaries here, we saw in the previous slide that you have a wide distribution of, let's say, semi-major axis of the two stars. So these binaries are very different within each other. So you would not expect maybe for such different systems that you would have the same influence on the planets also, if there is any.
There are really two classes of binaries in there. Mm-hmm. There's a 20AU, which really should be dynamically significant. And then the others, which I think anything above 20AU is not a semi-major axis, it's a projected separation.
From here. I mean, some of those are spectroscopic binaries, I think. Gamma-SEF, these... I don't know whether all of them, but maybe all three of them here. And those are typically, I mean, common proper motion binaries or visual binaries.
They don't have pairings that are pretty small. It's hard to see how much dynamics they're going to be doing on the bottom of the bottom. Whereas those three at the bottom, clearly, that's an area which can be very interesting. And if you know, if those three were the three on the upper left, then I'd say that would really mean something. Yeah.
This one here is certainly on the lower left, this one here. And this one. This one, but these two maybe just not. All right. Can I translate? I mean, it's up to you guys to do all this. I'm just, this is only my introduction. Yeah, I'm doing some numerical models. And you can always do nice numerical models, even though there's no trend at all in these data. But I mean.
While we're interrupting it, the time scale, but if you take typical parameters, say roughly equal mass binaries, the Jupiter, say 1AU or something, at what binary separation does the Kozai period become, say, a billion years? Beyond that, you can't possibly do anything.
I don't know. I mean, you would know this.
It's around 5,000.
Binary companion.
It will depend on the periaps,
right?
Yeah, depends on the periaps.
2,000 AU. Yeah, okay.
It's like 1,000 AU.
Yes. You did this for this system here, yeah?
That one is perfectly fine to migrate all the way in.
So it's quite conceivable that all the ones that are coming to the second time scale could still do a lot.
It's Kozai, not in motion. You know, sort of runs the
ship. Yes. Okay.
I would also point out, though, that if you gave our solar system a solar mass companion and 500 AU, it would be very disruptive to our present planetary system.
Solar mass
companion.
Solar? 500 AU? On the eccentric orbit?
Well, I'm saying the circular orbit, you say, between 250 and 500 AU.
Your time is up.
Yeah, I need to. Sorry, I need to interrupt this discussion. I can just put on the next one.
Good.
Yeah, we should talk later.
I just put on the next slide here, and so everybody could look at it already. So what it's here on eccentricity versus period in days, and here again, red means binary stars. And what is striking here, I don't need to say it. I don't know whether they claim also there's some statistical significance. I could not follow, I must say, the calculation in detail and say how high the unlikelihood of not having binary stars in here or not is. But anyhow, the striking feature claimed by the authors is that here, for the binary stars, you tend to have lower eccentricities in the inner region here. And for those regions outside here, they claim they have the same median medium eccentricity as the single stars here. Okay. So, and coming back to my hobby, basically is doing hydrodynamical evolutions here, and what I have done already some years ago, but only published in some obscure conference proceedings, I have to admit, is the evolution of an embedded planet in a disk plus a companion binary star. And we consider here a circumstellar disk around the primary star and then add a secondary star, which orbits the primary on a particular orbit. We do a two-dimensional approximation, so the whole system is coplanar, so nothing like Kozai and other effects here. There's 2D hydro in this disk, and then we solve the three-body problem and take into account the forces of the disk acting onto the objects, but no self-gravity of the disk.
So
this is
the binary in circular orbit?
No. I will come to the parameters now, the model parameter for this case. Thank you, Doug, for giving this. So we have a disk, typical range, relatively small. Here, 0.01 in mass, and you can see the other parameters, some density profile, Reynolds number 10 to the 5, I guess this should read. Mach number 20 of the disk, means H over R 0.05. One Jupiter mass at a typical radius, one solar mass, and the planet can grow here, which is one feature I could point out. And then we have a secondary here, the parameters 0.5, solar masses here, and eccentricity of 0.5. And the distance, did I mention the distance here, the secondary? Well, I vary the distance here. The semi-major axis goes from 10 to 20 semi-major axis of the Jupiter. So this is something like from, just multiplied 50 AU to 100 AU, roughly, the distance. So we expect there is some influence on the evolution of the planet here. And then I just integrate, follow this system here for hundreds of orbits. And you can just hear the influence this secondary, which is on a highly eccentric orbit, has on the disk. So we see the whole, we start the system with an axisymmetric disk, put the planet here already with a gap, or not, that would not make a difference, but we take a gap here initially, here's the planet, and the Roche lobe is indicated here also, and after 5 orbits of the planet, that is 10 orbits, 12, and so on, and you can see whenever the secondary star comes in close, you have strong spiral arms developing in the disk, which will eventually lead to a disk truncation, at some radius, which is here, whatever, several Jupiter radii. And then whenever it comes back in again, you again have these spiral arms. But the truncation radius, as we will see, stays relatively constant.
For this example, what was the centimeter
axis? I think this was 15 Jupiter distances.
So it's coming into 7.5.
Yes. Yeah. I think so. I think this was this model.
And the orbital period is what
The orbital period of the binary?
Yeah.
It's something like, well, you can calculate it from Kepler's law, I guess, but I don't. So this shows two pericenters here. I think this is the first one, so it shows probably three pericenters here. Yeah? Yeah? So one is at 12, then you have one in between here, and then you have another one at. Not really. We will always find the strong disturbances of the disk. I will show some movies later on, if they work. The planet is free to move. So this is an n-body problem, three-body problem, and the disk, which exerts forces onto the three bodies, basically. I mean, you can do it differently. I mean, that's in fact how I did this simulation. Normally, you would just have the star run around a few times, bring the disk in equilibrium, sort of, and then add the planet. But that's not what we did here. But that's how you would do it. This just started with the regular disk. So basically, to see the difference, what happens to a planet if you just put it in the disk, if you have an evolution without a star, and if you just add the star, then it just delineate the differences between those two evolutions. Initially, yes. We will see how it adjusts. Okay, the planet is initially in a circular orbit, but the star is in an eccentric orbit, right? And of course, this does not follow the previous evolution from very low masses of the planet. But that's the way how I did it. And with Richard together, we are now working on all the other, let's say, fine prints here. Okay, so we have this was the reference case. Let's say 15. Jupiter distance, so 76 astronomical units away. And here's the azimuthally average density profile in the disk plotted. So black is shortly after start. Then we have 25 orbits, the gray curve, red curve, 50 orbits, and so on. And you can see the disk from initially covering the whole region here slowly begins, the average profile begins to move inwards, and then it stays relatively constant here at a certain radius, which depends on the mass ratio of the star and on the eccentricity and the viscosity of the disk, which we compared to simulations and calculations by Pavel Artimovich and Stephen Lubow some years ago, and this fits very nicely.
F1 is one orbital period, 2 pi.
5 here means 5 orbital initial orbital periods of the planets.
Okay.
So this is 500,
so 500
times 11 point something. Sorry?
500 means that there's 8 binary orbital periods. Is that correct?
Yes, approximately. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's sorry to interrupt. How symmetric is it at Q equals 500?
The disk, you mean? I will show this movie. So from here you can't see anything. I will show this the movie later on. That's why I have to do it very fast here. I'm way over my number of slides here already. Okay, so and here is just here I varied the secondary distance. I mean, as I told you, after 500 orbits already after 250, these let's say mean distance or mean it's with the mean outer radius of the disk does not change very much anymore with time. Yes, even though the star comes in once in a while, it disturbs the disk. But if you look at the mean radius of the disk, mean outer radius of the disk, it's relatively stationary. And then you can compare those for the different parameters. And this we compared with Pavel's calculation. I don't know whether Pavel is here some years ago. And this fits very nicely for the parameters for the star, for the eccentricity and so on, viscosity we used. It's really very, very good fit. So we can see the closer in the star is basically we get a smaller disk, which is then, in a sense, more compressed. So, okay, what does the evolution of a planet do? So we have in black the unperturbed case, no secondary star, otherwise same initial conditions. Then in red, we start with the star which is far away, 20, 15, and 12.5. Jupiter distances, that is always. And we can see that if we reduce the semi-major axis, the distance of the star, we see that the planet migrates faster. So here's time, and we can see here the distance. This is semi-major axis of the planet, so it migrates in faster if you, let's say, compress the disk, which is not unexpected because of higher density there, and you have more mass, let's say, to push the planet, roughly speaking, inside. And this is the mass of the planet. So we follow here the mass increase in the planet here, and you can see it grows much faster. But this is also clear because you compress the disk relatively to the unperturbed case, you tend to grow much faster than you do without this compression here. So this is, we start out with one Jupiter mass here, and it's relatively flat. You can see the first time the star already comes in, then you shoot up here because you have much mass added onto the planet. But this is, in a sense, how much mass it's the planet gains, of course, depends on numerics, and I don't want to go into all the details here. So the eccentricity of the planet, there was another question. Eccentricity is, these are the same cases here, the same color coding. When the star is far away, the eccentricity does not grow as much, only to 0.1, but then it begins to drop again and oscillates. For this case, I don't know, but the other cases here, it oscillates and begins slowly to decline. Eccentricity. So a fast rise initially after the disk changes its structure very fast, and then you begin to have an adjustment of the eccentricity. I have done a case with three-body interactions. You would hardly see anything. It depends, of course, strongly also on the distance of the star. I don't know how high the eccentricity would go there. It should not damp. Yeah, that's true. These oscillations, yeah, maybe. And of course, I mean, this is always the space, and you can see how often the binary comes in here.
When you're talking about the planet's mass growth, what are you assuming for the planet to, what's required?
Well, typically in these calculations, the planet is just a point mass. And the potential is just created by adding some sort of smoothing to this point mass potential. And the mass of the planet can change if you add some mass from its environment, and typically you add mass within the Roche lobe or within a fraction of the Roche lobe. I can't remember. That's the whole point. I mean, I can't remember exactly what I did here. I usually do it this way, that I take 0.5 of the Roche lobe, and all the mass which is inside this radius of 0.5 Roche radii is taken partly out at some rate, yeah, which gives to a half emptying time. I think I calculated this once about a few orbits, two orbits or something, of the planet would be the half emptying time of this mass taken out here. Yeah, and typically I take half the Roche radius where I take out the mass.
So the gravitational potential of the disk is not included. Is that correct?
It's not self-gravitating.
Yes, well, on but the orbit of the planet.
Of course, you have to include it, otherwise it would not migrate.
No.
That's included.
Well, that's a torque.
Yes.
You calculate a torque, but to the axisymmetric part of the...
Here you calculate explicitly each gravitational contribution from each element of the disk. You don't do any torque calculation.
Yes. You just sense there's some box of gas in it, has a certain mass, and it pulls on everything.
So the precession...
Except the other gas.
The precession is...
It's included.
It's included. Yeah, automatically it's included. Yes, I mean, this is... You don't do it by a torque calculation, but you explicitly calculate the gravitational interaction between the disk, whatever, an element, volume element of the computational domain and your planet here. So all the forces are typically included. So I think I had this. Did I have this? Okay, the new numerical experiment, the other, let's say... half of the talk. So here we just try to figure out more details, because that other one was just, let's say, a preliminary calculation, which was never really followed up in too much detail. So we defined a basic state here and try to figure out what, at the present time, what numerical effects there are. I mean, this is only something for specialists. You can have, of course, a resolution is very simple resolution, but you can have equidistant grids, non-equidistant grids, and so on. You have a torque cutoff, as I call it here, which is, of course, a misnomer following the discussion with Doug now here, because it's essentially a force cutoff. Yeah, that means inside some radius close to the planet, the material which is inside that radius is not taken into account in calculating the mutual forces of the disk and the planet. Okay, that's what this means. And you can also choose 0.5 of the planetary, of the Roche radius, for example. Yeah. A mass accretion onto planet and so on can play a role in these computations. And as we shall see, they do. I will just show one thing before I show some movies which may be more interesting. So here, basically, it's only understandable for me. I don't know whether you can read this anyhow. Semi-major axis here, and here's time. Plotted for such a case, black, the undisturbed case, and there are two cases, the red and the green one here, where the disk is larger than in the other two cases, and here's equidistant, and here we have a different torque cutoff here. First, I take out everything which is inside the Roche lobe is not taking part in the computation, and here everything which is inside two-thirds of the Roche radius is not taking part in the computation. And the main difference, to summarize, is these two curves have a torque cutoff which is both smaller than in the other two cases, despite the different resolution of the grid. Okay, so what we can see is that whether a planet migrates inwards or outwards may depend, or will depend, I can really say, will depend on what you are doing with your forces in the vicinity of the planet. I mean, this is nothing new, really. And all the numerical attempts which have been made recently doing subgrids, modeling of planets in disks, or let's say refine the grid very close to the planet like Matthew Bate does and others, they basically come down to this effect to delineate here what is here numerics and what is real physics here and those things. It plays a role because with a grid like this, I don't even want to plot it. I mean, the Roche radius of the planet is only marginally resolved, I would call it. Yes, it's very hard. You need an extremely high resolution near the planet to get it right. And with a moving planet, it's very difficult. I mean, some people have adaptive mesh refinement codes, and so we will have to wait what they can do, or you move a certain subgrid with it, and we are still working on it, what you can do. But that's what you get. So you get different migration rates, inward or outward, whether it's type 2 or 3, I don't even want to comment on. Here it's different eccentricities. Here it's not as bad for the eccentricities. Here you can see that primarily in the eccentricities, it seems to be more the grid structure which changes the result here. So maybe you have a little bit under-resolved it concerning this.
Results, that's probably dominated just by the secular effect. It is worthwhile. You really should have this restricted free body curve.
Yes. I think I did it once, but I can't remember how the curves compare.
Yes. You get this. Especially if you put in the disk potential in it, because it provides some...
You will get some sort, but you will probably not get the damping of the eccentricities in the end.
Oh,
I don't know.
It's not damping. You just
Compare this. Here you can see the binary orbit elements. So the binary is slightly expanding, and the eccentricity is also changing slightly. And they just, the curves just vary. So this is because this is the period of the binary. When it comes into the star, to the primary star, it changes more. So here's the first movie now, but here I have to go out of this and start it here.
It's a binary change.
Because you have also forces of the disk acting on it. Yes, and the disk dissipates some energy and momentum, so you can see here. So how, now we can maybe, this is, I will just start it now, you can just look at it. So the binary just came in, and now the disk settles to a sort of quasi-stationary state. And the binary will now come in again. You can see what it does. Yeah, it disturbs the disk very strongly. And you can see the time here on the top right. This is in planetary orbits. So this is already quite far in the system here. And you can, this is a time sequence from 150 to 300. Every snapshot is at one, delta t equals one planetary orbit. Yes. But you can see the disk here is eccentric. I will show some other plots here if I have time. Yes, and so the planet is moving around here. And sometimes, as will become more obvious, another plot, which I will show, it even touches the inner edge of the disk. Yes.
Sorry if I missed it. Is there mass loss?
At the outer parts of the disk, I did not.
You're shocked. Do you actually get stuff out?
It would get out here of the outer, but I do not take it out. I just leave it in there. It would not be very much, though.
Yes. Well, but not very much per orbit.
But it would add up. You're right, it would add up. But in this computation, presently, I did not take out any mass on the outer domain.
Pretty much every time you shock, it's going to be
some. Every time, you can see this very clearly, the shock fronts hit the outer boundary, and so you will lose the mass, so that's clear. And I think Richard Nelson has taken that part. He opened the outer boundary. But for the first orbits of the planet, this does not make too much of a difference because the matter is is very little, but on a long time scale, of course, clearly, will make a difference.
I guess I would visit the planet on some not so long time scale, it might drain
the. No, I mean, you can calculate this, and I think if I remember Richard's results here correctly, it's not very much. I mean, you can see this here, the density is very low here in the outer parts, and if you were to extend the computational domain, you would probably keep again more mass, so you would lose even less, and so. But I agree, one should include it, the mass loss there.
Remind me of the geometry here. So where is the pericenter of the binary? Where
initially, I put it, where did I put it? It's along this line, yeah, along this line here. The pericenter, I started at upper center, and I think I started to the right, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, so pericenter would be here, but it's along this line.
And the gap is not asymmetric, so the.
Sorry?
The gap around the planet.
This one here, yeah?
Yeah,
that's very weird also.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know, I must say. I mean, this is just, these are our first computations here, and we have to analyze it. I mean, if I.
More than one binary orbit, right?
I will show something about the disk eccentricity in one plot. I will. Just hold on a second. So you see the same thing in a different coordinate system, just to make it easier for you guys, yeah, where things are. And you can see the disk is eccentric in a sense, but it does not change very much. And I calculated the mean eccentricity and mean peri-astron of the disk, and it's relatively constant throughout this computation. Yes? As I said, it was, I think, along, definitely, it was, I started it at y equals 0, so along the x-axis I started it, and it was in in upper astron. And the planet was on the same side, I think, but also on circular orbit.
It goes all the line out, I mean, the upper, yeah, it's all the way out to the dark radius.
Yes.
Well, not at late times, you can see it, it's always about 1.5, you know,
yes.
pi over 2, somewhere right around there, right? That the peak is always there.
Yes. I will show the plot. But here you can see that the planet at some point hits slightly here the inner edge of the eccentric disk. And then some things happen, of course. And that's what you need to calculate. You can see it when it comes in there now, around a little bit after 200. See, some material is apparently orbiting here and then going away to larger distances, and some material is going inside. And depending which is more, that will influence, of course, the direction of the planet migration also. Do I have some time, Doug, still?
You have minus 2 minutes.
Okay, then I still have time, okay. This is maybe not so illuminating, but nevertheless, another movie I made. This is just the average surface density in the disk with time. Time is again up there, sigma versus radius in the disk. And you can see here that on average, this, what I told you, this slope, it does not change very much. Only if the star comes in now, the star comes in, it's changing a little bit. And here you could estimate how much material is leaving then the system also. But if you were to take out the computational domain a little bit further, so you could maybe keep also more material. This was my point.
Do you have a reflecting boundary?
Here in this case, this is open at the inner side, so mass can leave here. And it does very slowly. And the outer side, you can see this from the curves, this is in fact reflecting the outer side. Reflecting outer boundary condition. Yeah? Okay. Now I have only two images more, and that's it. I think I'm here now.
You don't have one with a triple system.
I have no triple system yet. So here are some questions which come up. These are the mean disk orbital elements you have here. Yeah? So this is the mean eccentricity of the disk versus time, and these three curves are just different types of taking this average. You see, one is just by grid points, other one is by volume, other one by mass. So you can see they follow somewhat this line here. So the mean eccentricity, in a way, gets up to 0.1, around 0.1 in the disk, which is the whole disk, not only the outer part. I did not distinguish this yet. That's the whole part of this. And this is the periastron, the mean periastron of this disk with the same type of average you see, and you can see it changes only very slowly. This is 4 in rads, in radians, and so it goes up to nearly 5. So this was, and if you look at this evolution of this simulation we have seen, which went from 150 here to 300, I think. And so you can see there's hardly any change during that short period in the disk mean elements. Okay, conclusions, you see, there we are. The binarity has some influence on, shouldn't really say planet formation, which is a different topic, but planetary evolution, let's say it really. Yeah? So if you have a big planet already, large planet already, then it will change the subsequent evolution. But to be consistent, of course, we should start with a very small planet or have the disk first relax in this binary system and then put in some planetesimals or whatsoever. So this is things we need to work on, of course. Secondary truncates and compress the disk. We have seen this, faster migration and larger masses. This was the initial result. Whether this holds if you start up with very small planets needs to be seen. Evolution for wide binaries, direction of migration needs to be figured out, what it is really. Planet formation in binaries, and there's some work by Andy Nelson, a different Nelson, which needs to be carefully distinguished, and by Edge Rowe recently here, and so we, this one is a different issue then, and then there are of course lots of other problems which we couldn't touch yet. So this is work in progress, and Richard Nelson will be here at the conference also, and of course we hope that we will continue this with them. Thank you.
Willie will be here for the next 3 weeks. Maybe we can just ask 2 questions.
I just wondered, when you calculate the force of the disk on the planet,
is Newton's third law respected? Not if you go deep inside the Roche lobe. Now the problem is, in my opinion, there is that to do it correctly, you would need to incorporate some self-gravitating structure in there, inside of the Roche lobe. And without doing this, you cannot really consistently fulfill Newton's law deep inside the Roche lobe. That's impossible. Yes, and I say usually, I mean, the planet cannot talk on itself. I mean, if you have Jupiter there sitting on itself, and it cannot exert some torques on itself. So, so there must be some radius where you don't include anything anymore. Or you calculate a completely self-gravitating object, which requires a resolution which is beyond everything, I think, which is manageable. But this is a serious problem, as you could see with the torque cutoff here. Yes, we could look into this. We haven't tried this actually, but you are right. You can exclude it into the other way around as well. Yes, okay. Yeah, we should do that. Mm-hmm.
Yes. What's the physics of this torque cutoff? How does it affect?
it's some, numerical game you have to play here, for one thing, because you can't go, if you take material which is very close to the, let's say, point source of the planet, actually, then this would create huge torques, huge forces on the planet, and the resolution, the numerical resolution in that region is not sufficiently enough to get the density structure right. In fact, it's completely off the density structure. So if you were to take those material into account in the force, you could get arbitrary results, and that's what people see sometimes, yes? You get, I mean, you can even get type 3 migration. No, I mean,
physics is whether your arm, which exerts a torque on your body, is part of your body.
Yes, that's what I mean by self-gravitating object. Yeah?
Okay, because your arm is so close to you, it exerts a large torque on your body, but if it's part of your body and you both move together, there is no net torque.
Yeah, so that's basically what I mean. If you have to do,
except that what Gordon was pointing out is that your body is in fact exerting force on your arm, which is not.
I can't say presently, Gordon, whether this will make a difference or not. This is one issue we certainly will have to look at. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That is smooth. There we are consistent. The back reaction is smoothed with the same potential. So this part is fine.
Yes.
Only the cutoff, I think, it's not taken into account if you do it the other way around. Yeah.
Okay, we've got to cut this off.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.